The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, friends. This is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you articles of interest from Kiplinger.com and also Money.com. First up is an article from Kiplinger.com, Seven Financial Considerations When Downsizing for Retirement. With prices going up on everything, you may be looking for a cheaper place to live. To truly evaluate cost, take a hard look at taxes and intangibles. Then thinking about where you will live, cost is an obvious factor, especially for retirees who are living off their savings and have to make that money last a lifetime. But it's not as clear-cut as it might seem. In my previous column, Three Steps for Evaluating a Downsize in Retirement, a Financial Planner's Guide, I outlined what I believe should be the primary drivers of where you end up when you downsize: health and social relationships. I want to repeat that I believe that the cost of your new home should be the primary driver only if it's a necessity. But for today's purposes, let's assume that you have checked the health and relationship boxes for the locations you're considering and now are on to weighing the cost. Well, here are seven key criteria to consider. Number one, housing cost, more than just dollars and cents. All the other categories we're going to talk about come with more black and white numbers than housing, because the true cost of housing involves a lot more than just the listing price. I had a friend moving here to Washington, D.C. after completing his Ph.D. at Penn State. He sent me a listing for a beautiful new townhouse on the water just across the bridge. It was close to D.C. and to a metro subway stop, and it looked like a good deal. The catch? It was in a very dangerous area. It would be hard for him to know that as an out-of-towner. It's also hard to decipher housing cost as a transplant. You can look at median housing cost, but they likely won't tell the whole picture. Here's what we do know. Cities are more expensive. The Northeast and West Coast are very expensive. The farther you get from these places, typically, the less you will have to pay. I always recommend that clients take a month-long trip to the metro areas they are considering. VRBO and Airbnb are making this much easier with long-term rentals. Cook meals in your rental. Walk around. Visit a coffee shop. See if you like life as a resident, not as a tourist. The question most people ask when considering a move to a much cheaper home is, how much more will I be able to spend per month? Of course, you can back of the envelope this by just seeing how much lower your housing costs would be. But if you want the full picture that factors in tax rates, maintenance cost, etc., you need financial planning software to help you. Number two, estate inheritance taxes can vary widely. From my office window in Virginia, I can see Maryland and D.C. Virginia has no estate or inheritance tax. The District of Columbia has an estate tax, but no inheritance tax. Maryland has both an estate tax and an inheritance tax. I'd literally swim across the polluted Potomac River to avoid the Maryland taxes. As of 2025, fewer than a third of states have an inheritance tax, a state tax, or both. As the federal estate tax exemption has grown so large, states have moved away from this tax. That said, this is still a consideration for many of our clients in high tax states. If you're in Pennsylvania and can move 5 minutes down the road to Delaware, it may be worth it. If you live in Maryland and can swim to Virginia, it may or may not be worth it. Number three, carefully compare state income tax rates. On the West Coast, if you're looking for a tax-friendly place to put down roots, you move to Washington or Nevada. On the East Coast, it's Florida or Tennessee. In the South, tax-friendly Texas is for the cowboys and musk lovers. There are now 9 states that have no income taxes. Having no state income tax is a pretty good sign that the state is overall tax friendly, but it can often lead to higher taxes on some of the other categories we'll discuss next. Once again, the Northeast is expensive, especially when it comes to income taxes. The picture is not always black and white. For example, in Maryland, the taxes look comparable to Virginia, with a progressive tax rate that tops out in the 5-6% range. However, Maryland has county supplements that add up to an additional 3.2%, which puts the state in the same range as D.C. This locality tax is not unique to Maryland and must be considered when evaluating new home states, counties, and townships. Number four, property tax rates play a role. Often when income tax rates are low, property tax rates are high. See Florida and Texas, for example. This can get a little muddy when you consider market value versus assessed value. In theory, these should be the same, but there are many areas where assessed values are considerably lower. Both Zillow and Redfin allow you to see past tax assessments. Many states also offer property tax discounts for seniors who have lived there for a specified number of years. It may not be a factor for that reason, unless you're considering downsizing in the same state. And number five, taxation on retirement accounts and pensions. Aside from your house, your retirement accounts are likely your biggest assets, and how they're taxed could have a big effect on your bottom line. Retirement accounts. This applies to IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, TSPs, and basically any retirement account that you have yet to pay taxes on. Obviously, the 9 states that have no income tax will not tax distributions from your retirement accounts. But there are a handful of states that have a state income tax, but do not tax distributions from retirement accounts. This is one reason while Pennsylvania is not often considered tax-friendly for workers, it is friendly for retirees. The more you've stashed away in pre-tax accounts, the more this matters. And pensions. The reason these two categories are grouped together is that most of the states that exempt retirement account distributions exempt several sources of retirement income. You should pay particular attention to this category if a large percentage of your retirement income is from a public or private pension. An increasingly majority of states fully or partially exempt military pensions. As of 2025, California and D.C. are the only 2 places that fully tax military pensions. And number six, taxation on Social Security. Most states do not tax income from Social Security. Some of the few that do include Colorado, Connecticut, and Vermont. Like so many of these things, this is not black and white. The majority of the states that do not tax Social Security have income bans or AGI limits on those tax benefits. And lastly, number 7, don't be dazzled by states with no sales tax. Delaware is often referred to as the, quote, tax-free state. This is misleading. Delaware has property taxes and income taxes, but does not have sales taxes. I think the focus on sales tax is often overrated. Let's say that you spend $10,000 per month. In many states, only about 50% of that spending is subject to income taxes. Let's say you pay 5% on that $5,000. That's $250 per month, or $3,000 per year. That's the difference if you're comparing 5% to 0%. The point is that you should not let a few points difference make or break your decision. Bottom line on considering housing cost in retirement is that you need to look beyond the home's price. Taxes can be a huge factor for retirees, and taking them into account is always a smart idea. Our next article, coming from Money.com, this article by Martha White. Even rich investors are wary of the stock market right now. Let me tell you about the very rich. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote 99 years ago, "They are different from you and me. However, despite having more money, it turns out that they are just as concerned as the rest of us about protecting their nest eggs from stock market tantrums." According to FINTRX, an analytics company that aggregates and studies data about family offices of ultra-high net worth, or UHNW, investors, direct investment deals fell by 32% in the first 6 months of 2025. These findings aren't surprising to advisors who work with wealthy investors. John Zimmerman, president of Accent Private Capital Management of U.S. Bank, says he sees two approaches from his UHNW clients. First, those who are involved in businesses or industries heavily impacted by tariffs are looking at strategies to mitigate their exposure. Second, those who don't need to be in markets right now are sidelining their cash. There's no urgency for them to deploy capital, Zimmerman says. They all basically said, we're going to wait and see what happens. Interest and wariness over AI, or artificial intelligence. Uber-wealthy investors are even given popular investing trends like technology and cyclical plays like healthcare, the cold shoulder, CNBC reported. It found that the only type of businesses in which direct investment rose within the first half of the year were those associated with artificial intelligence. Advisors who work with this population can confirm that. Companies involved with AI continue to be of interest, Zimmerman says. We are in a tech-driven economy. Although this drives ongoing enthusiasm, Zimmerman advises caution. Valuations are very hard to identify because the multiples are so high, he says, buoyed by optimism and hopes that may or may not come to fruition. If you're a fundamentals investor, valuations become very difficult, he says. Jonathan Flack, U.S. and Global Family Office Practice Lead for consulting firm PwC, said one way UHNW investors are approaching this challenge is by focusing their investments on what might be described as the scaffolding being used to build out and grow the AI industry. They're actually making investments in the data centers and the hard assets that are going to be needed to support AI and the growth of AI, Flack said in a CNBC interview. Diversification provides cash flow and risk mitigation. Nancy McColgan, Managing Director of Verdance Family, a division of Verdance Capital Advisor, says that her UHNW clients today are looking to hedge risk. We don't have a lot of family offices that want to invest in single direct investments. It lacks diversification, she says, adding that investment pools that incorporate multiple assets are more appealing. Income-producing assets also are in high demand among UHNW investors. In some cases, they may be looking for assets that throw off cash flow as opposed to growth only, McCulligan says. She notes that while the market's appreciation has been robust, much of that momentum is driven by tech companies that have great future potential but don't provide a steady income stream. Obviously, the stock market has produced a lot of growth, but it's been highly concentrated. They also want opportunities to make sure that their portfolios are producing cash, she says. Her clients are interested in sectors like energy and utilities, as well as other infrastructure assets like toll roads and bridges. Real estate is another asset class wealthy investors are seeking out for its potential to generate cash flow. Almost all of our ultra-high net worth clients are interested in real estate in one way or another, Zimmerman says. When there's a lot of economic uncertainty, tangible assets tend to be where people gravitate to, he says. Real estate tends to be a safe haven in these sorts of times. Real estate can also provide liquidity and free cash flow, especially for building types in high demands, McCulligan adds. Certainly, in multifamily housing in most areas, it's pretty high occupancy, she says. You don't need to be rich to invest like them. While wealth unlocks investing opportunities for the rich that most people with just a 401k or a brokerage account might not have access to, you don't need to have a family office or a high net worth to take a page from the playbook of UHNW investors. For the most part, this means having a plan, sticking to it, and evaluating potential investments on their fundamentals rather than hype. Positive or negative. I'm just seeing a lot of scrutiny, Vicki Odette, a partner in the law firm of Hayes Boone, told CNBC. Every investor should make sure that they don't overreact to market activity, McCulligan says. Approach any type of reactive market with caution, but don't approach it with a must do something immediately mindset. And here's an interesting article from Money.com. Can Trump force drug makers to lower the cost of your prescriptions? This article by Adam Hardy. The Trump administration is launching a pressure campaign against prescription drug makers in an effort to get them to lower prices for everyday Americans. President Donald Trump sent letters to at least 17 major drug makers, including AstraZeneca, Eli Lilly, Johnson & Johnson, and Pfizer, and posted them publicly on his social media site, Truth Social Thursday. In the letters, Trump gave the pharmaceutical firms until September the 29th to make a series of commitments that aim to provide immediate relief from the vastly inflated drug prices and put an end to the free ride of American innovation by European and other developed nations. The letters by the president ratcheted up the rhetoric towards drug makers by directly demanding that specific companies start providing Americans with the lowest price offered in other developed nations, a pricing approach also known as the, quote, most favored nation model. There's no reason American consumers should pay substantially more than other countries for the same drug in the same packaging and manufactured in the same factory, the White House said in a statement on Monday. Trump's recent statements are the latest attempt by his administration to lower drug prices using the president's executive power. Meanwhile, experts are beginning to question if that unilateral approach is the most effective way to meaningfully lower the cost of drugs. Drug companies may respond to pressure tactics of the sort that President Trump is using. Juliet Kubansky, Deputy Director of Medicare Policy at the nonprofit KFF, says in an email to Money. But that response is unlikely to be substantially reducing drug prices across the board. On the other hand, Chris Meekins, a healthcare policy analyst at Raymond James, told Barron's on Thursday that despite the rhetoric, the letters could actually be backpedaling on demands made by Trump's executive order on drug prices signed in May. Originally, he said, the U.S. will get the best price that any other nation gets for all products, Meekins says. Now, he's carving out specific categories. Trump's demands to lower drug prices. The letters Trump addressed directly to the heads of 17 pharmaceutical companies include four key demands. The drug makers must provide their full portfolio of existing drugs at the lowest price offered to other similar nations, aka the most favored nation price, to all patients on Medicaid, the government's health care plan for low-income and disabled Americans. For all newly developed drugs, the companies must contract with the federal government to provide all Americans, whether they have public or private health insurance, the most favored nation price. Trump ordered the pharmaceutical companies to negotiate with other countries in coordination with the U.S. in order to return increased revenues abroad to American patients and taxpayers. Drug makers were ordered to develop direct-to-consumer and direct-to-business drug sales models that effectively eliminate middleman drug management companies that mark up prices. Trump said he expects the companies to engage with his administration immediately and in good faith to meet the demands by September the 29th. The letters also suggest that the initial negotiations with drug makers following his May executive order did not go as intended. Most proposals my administration has received to resolve this critical issue promise more of the same, Trump wrote, shifting blame and requesting policy changes that would result in billions of dollars in hands out to the community and industry. If the companies don't comply, the president threatened to deploy every tool in our arsenal to get them to lower drug prices. PHRMA, a pharmaceutical industry trade group, strongly opposes the so-called most favored nation approach, saying that it would be a bad deal for American patients and workers that could threaten American innovation. Can Trump actually make drug companies lower prices? In the U.S., prescription drug prices are uniquely high, especially for brand name drugs. According to KFF, the popular weight loss drug Ozempic, for example, is over 10 times pricier than in some peer countries. The monthly list price for Ozempic in the U.S. is $936, KFF says. The second most expensive country in the analysis is Japan, where it costs $169. In Sweden, the UK, Australia, and France, it's under $100. Zooming out, Americans spend about $100 billion out of pocket for their prescriptions last year, a record high. Regardless of political affiliation, exorbitant drug prices are a major issue. According to a separate KFF report, 73% of Americans say there isn't enough regulation on the price of prescription drugs. Enter Trump's renewed push to lower drug prices. They follow several initiatives by the Biden administration to do the same. At the start of the year, for example, a $2,000 annual out-of-pocket drug price cap went into effect for Medicare Part D beneficiaries as part of former President Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. That law also allowed for Medicare to negotiate prices with drug makers for the first time ever on select high-cost drugs. Those negotiated prices are slated to go into effect in 2026, with additional drug negotiations underway. In April, Trump signed an executive order seeking to expand those negotiations while encouraging the production of cheaper generic equivalents of high-cost name-brand medications. Then came his May order and August letters advocating for most-favored nation pricing. Trump told reporters Sunday that his efforts have dramatically lowered drug prices already. "You know, we've cut drug prices by 1,200, 1,300, 1,400, 1,500%," Trump said, without providing evidence. "I don't mean 50%, I mean 14, 1,500%. Mathematically, it's impossible for prices to drop by more than 100%. Despite both Biden and Trump's efforts, annual prescription costs rose 1.2% as of June, according to the Labor Department. As a result of Trump's pressure, Kubansky and KFF says some manufacturers have indeed made new commitments to invest in American production of prescription drugs or introduce new options for consumers to purchase drugs directly rather than going through insurers or other middlemen. But so far, she adds, these changes aren't broad-based solutions to the plight of high drug prices in the U.S. She says if lowering prices were as easy as ordering drug companies to lower them through pressure or executive action, it probably would have already been done. Without legislation action, she says, we may not see the systematic price reductions that President Trump is pushing for. Well, we are out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, this is Larry Wilson. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is also available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks again for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.